Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming along to the Lowy Institute today. Today is our Lowy AMP China lecture, and we are delighted to have with us Paul Bluestein, who has a long and exciting history of writing and thinking about global economic governance and Asia and China. So let me give you the official version of that. He's a long career examining the economic order in Asia, spanning both journalism and think tanks. He is currently Senior Fellow at the Centre for International Governance Innovation, has held a visiting fellowship at what is now the Peterson Institute for International Economics, served as journalist in residence at the Brookings Institution. He has written extensively for the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, where he was the Tokyo correspondent for 5 years and still currently lives in Japan. He's also written 5 books focusing on international economic institutions. So, an expert in this field without any doubt. So we're very pleased to have him along here so I can ask some questions and he can answer them in great detail. So we're talking today about China entering the WTO in 2001, a watershed in the history of globalization and a big step in integrating China into the global economy. It's had profound impacts, both positive and negative, and for China and the rest of the world. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about the global economic governance system today and China's role in that. So, Paul, let's get started with just a little bit of a question about the background on China's accession to the WTO in 2001. Why was this a big deal for both China and for the world?
It was perceived as a big deal at the time, and I think we're now, 15 years later, 16 years later, because this was in 2001, seeing really that it was even more of a huge watershed than we appreciated at the time. And for China, there were two major motivations. One was the leadership, and particularly the premier at that time, Zhu Rongji, believed that if China opened up its markets more than they already were, dramatically more, that this would be, this would help the economy grow. It would be tough on a lot of special interest groups that had enjoyed protection from foreign competition, but that reform was what the economy needed, more free market orientation. But the most important motivation is to think, what is the WTO as in terms of the multilateral trading system. The WTO is this wonderful, I get kind of starry-eyed and weepy about it. It's this wonderful institution which basically says we're not going to go back to the 1930s. We're not going to go back to the days when countries could declare trade wars on each other and form trade blocs. We're going to have a system where if you're in, then you're protected against that kind of thing. Because if a country just capriciously raises its tariffs against you, then you can say, well, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to take you to a court, and they'll say what you did was against the rules, and then there'll be sanctions imposed against you for doing that. And China at that time was not being in the WTO. They were vulnerable, particularly to that kind of threat from the U.S. because the U.S. in those days was particularly after the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989. Was threatening the Chinese with tariffs for human rights violations. Every year there would be a vote in Congress, and Congress would regularly pass the saying, okay, we will keep our markets open to Chinese products, but it was anxiety provoking for companies that were thinking of investing in China to think that perhaps the biggest market would be closed off. So China had a huge motivation for wanting to be inside the tent, where they would be protected against that type of capricious, declaration of trade war, particularly by their biggest customer. So the WTO is a very important institution for that reason. China could easily see why it was crucial for them to be in. So it was a watershed for their economy.
And, I mean, there were, of course, huge responsibilities then for China as well. It had Absolutely. Implications for its economy domestically. Can you talk a little bit about what impact that had?
Well, there was great trepidation. I'm working on a book about China in the WTO now, and I've gone back and looked at what people were saying at that time. It's really quite striking. There were a lot of, there was tremendous fear in China that letting the multinationals in and having all this foreign competition was going to, was, you know, a lot of Chinese industry would be decimated. Even a lot of foreign economists were predicting, well, you know, the Chinese don't have, they don't have any big international brand name companies. They still, they're still rather few. Gosh, you know, they're going to be overrun. What are they doing? This is really a big risk for them. And a lot of, you know, people forget this, but a lot of Chinese suffered. I mean, whenever you open your economy and you know, you may be creating a lot of dynamism, but it's, there's a creative destruction. There's creation, but there's also destruction. So the, so there are a lot of state-owned enterprises were either shut down or forced to merge. People, you know, lost their livelihoods, their privileged positions. So yes, there were absolutely responsibilities for China to yeah, when you sign up to this thing, and in fact, China entered the WTO on under what was by far the most onerous set of conditions, by far of any country that had ever gotten in. They were required to lower their tariffs much lower than other developing countries. They were required to sign onto all kinds of commitments. And this was all under the, you know, for the Clinton administration. Their U.S. Trade Representative at that time, Charlene Barshefsky, I'll tell you, is no shrinking violet. There were some incredibly tough negotiations when you sometimes hear Donald Trump today saying, "Our stupid trade negotiators give everything away." I'm telling you, you look back at these negotiations. I covered some of them for the Washington Post. They were very tough. So yes, the obligations were immense, and yet China has thrived.
That's right. So the positive implications for China has been a huge burst of growth from then.
I went to the trouble of looking up the numbers. It's 2001. China's GDP was $1.3 trillion U.S. dollars. It is now 11.5. In 2016, $11.5 trillion. I mean, that's, you know, In 15, 16 years, that's, you know, we all know, this is no mystery to anybody in this room, I'm sure, that China has grown at very impressive rates. I got to say, I'm sure many of you, you know, I mean, people in Australia, you know, you get around a lot. And so I'm sure many of you have been to China and perhaps you went there some years ago. I have just been in May for the first time in a while. And one of the places I went was Shanghai. And you know, I've read that Shanghai was become, you know, I mean, I've read about the fantastic skyline. I was last in Shanghai in 1993, and you couldn't get anywhere in a taxi because there'd be like 9 bicycles in front of you going at a snail's pace, right? And it would take about 2 or 3 hours to get anywhere, you know, in any distance in a taxi. And Pudong, you know, which is now this fantastic urban center, you know, unbelievable skyline, was nothing. There was nothing there. There was the Pearl Tower was half built. And I was actually there to do a story about the Chinese, for the Washington Post, for the Chinese who were saying, we are going to turn this into a financial center. It's going to be another Hong Kong, you'll see. And I was like, really? I'm happy to say I took down what they said and I pretty much printed what they told me because, boy, to get around Shanghai now, I'm sure many of you have been there just as, you know, in recent period. The subway gets you anywhere you want to go in no time at all, and it's orderly.
It's a spectacular
success, and of course Chinese elites have benefited immensely, but the Chinese people, these are hundreds of millions of people whose lives have been improved. It's heartwarming.
And what about in that's the sort of the domestic Chinese positive and negatives. What about in the international arena? How did China's accession to WTO impact internationally?
Well, it's been, you know, the Chinese, they did a tremendous amount of reform and opening up, and a lot of multinational companies came in and made a lot of money, and imports have also risen pretty impressively. It's a big market. And having China, you know, in the tent, in the international rules system is you know, better than not. Having said that, China has taken a turn in recent years. Well, before, even before the, in recent years, there was the, a period of time from about 2003 to 2011 or so, where China was keeping its currency. I mean, you know, there's a lot of argument about the degree, but I think there's no question that the currency was grossly undervalued. Now, there's no rule in the international system that really clearly states that, you know, a country can't do that. I mean, there are rules that you're not really supposed to in the IMF, right? But it's a very hard thing to determine what's a fair value for a currency. And then by keeping its currency undervalued, China was able to give its exporters tremendous benefits. Now they argue that they had good reasons for doing this. And this, after all, was in many ways a benefit to foreign countries because they were able to buy pretty darn good products cheaply. I remember having arguments with some Chinese officials during this time. They would say, why are you upset about this? I mean, you know, you get the benefit of our cheap products and we're subsidizing you in effect. And I understand that argument, but when you're in a manufacturing company abroad, having to compete with products that are much cheaper than your own, partly because some other country, especially a big, powerful exporter, is keeping its currency low, that's a big problem. And you think that it doesn't strike you as very fair. And I think that's pretty reasonable. So again, this was the first part of the story from the international side. But then in starting again in about 2003, when President Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao replaced the regime of Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji, China began, reforms really slowed down, and the enthusiasm for opening up diminished, and some institutions were set up in 2003 that gave the government much greater control over state-owned enterprises. In 2006, China began moving toward the policy of much more state control over what was coming in, what was going, and trying to promote national champions, the indigenous innovation policy began appearing in about 2009 in a serious way. Of course, now foreign companies raised hell about this and said, you can't, that's not fair, and the Chinese government would scale it back, but. Particularly now under Xi Jinping, I'd say the government has moved even further in the direction of I think it's fair to call it a much more mercantilistic, techno-nationalistic policy of trying to promote domestic Chinese companies at the expense of foreign competitors. They still welcome foreign investment to some extent. It's not as if it's a closed system. It's not a command economy. China is still very, it's in many ways an extremely competitive, capitalistic system where companies knock each other's brains out to compete. But the economy has become much more state controlled, and this is also a problem for foreign companies. Even if they're not in China, if they're competing with Chinese companies, the Chinese have found a lot of clever ways, again, that don't violate the rules necessarily, of subsidizing their exports. So moves in recent years have. The Chinese are, I think, very good about trying to maintain adherence to the letter of the international rules. And when they are hauled before the WTO and accused of violating the rules, if the WTO says, yes, you violated the rules, the Chinese, oh, okay, we'll stop. We're so sorry. We apologize. And they're much better about adhering to those than certain countries like mine. but still, it's a big problem for the system.
So we've got China, we've got an increase in state control over the domestic economy in China, starting with Hu and increasing under Xi. And on the other hand, we've got Trump's ambivalence about globalization. And if we are allowed to have a third hand, we've got Xi Jinping standing up at Davos being the poster boy for globalization. How do these things fit together, this sort of global environment in which Trump and the US seem to be backing out, Xi Jinping is everything we've dreamed of, and at the same time, though domestically there's more state control. How can we reconcile those things?
Well, I think it's all very worrisome because I don't see. I mean, Xi Jinping, I think, should be congratulated for a fantastic exercise in public relations by standing up in Davos and basically saying, well, if the U.S. is going to bow out of its role as world leader, we'll do our best and we'll step in. That would be wonderful if, I don't think that under Donald Trump we're in any shape to exercise global leadership, and I'm afraid that any whatever global leadership we try to exercise may be, we can hope that it'll be responsible. I'm not very optimistic, but I see no particular reason for optimism that China can, and I don't think China really wants to. People used to talk about this about Japan, the country where I live now. And the Japanese. No. We'll be the best number two country. We will try our best to be the best number two country. You guys lead. We can't. And I think that's. China. Have rightly tremendously proud of its growth and its wealth, its power accumulated in the past decade and a half and going back to around the late 70s, but I don't think the Chinese leadership feels that it is. I mean, they want to exercise a tremendous amount of power and leadership in this region, no question about that, because they see their national interests as being threatened, particularly by the U.S. Navy, which I understand. But I don't see them wanting to exercise the kind of leadership at a multilateral level that the U.S. did. I don't see that there'd be much chance that most countries would find them suitable for following. Partly because, particularly in the trade area, which we're focusing on now, China is not particularly an exemplar of openness and fairness. So, I'm not saying the U.S. is either, but.
So, what do you think? What do you think was the purpose of Xi Jinping's Davos speech? It's an interesting question about whether or not China has the will and the capability to exercise this kind of governance. What do you think? Why do you think he wanted to give the impression that they could?
Oh, well, I mean, it's partly to diffuse the criticism that's often directed at China, particularly not just from people who believe, follow Donald Trump and his trade representative, Bob Lighthizer, is famously vituperative about Chinese economic practices. And I think it was partly to diffuse that, partly to take advantage of a perception that the U.S. is kind of stumbling in this regard, but then that China has come a tremendously long way, and it certainly, I'm sure, it appealed to his domestic audience. Chinese, again, I think, take tremendous pride in I mean, that's not a very novel way of looking at it, but can you tell me? Tell me.
No, you're the expert. But yeah. do you think that China might find itself forced to? There may be expectations then on the international and maybe the domestic stage as well that China may have to take a more active role.
Well, they will, of course, do what they have to protect their their interests and to guard against the kinds of incursions on their on their national interests that they felt that they feel threatened by. And at the same time the Chinese are feeling their oats, right? But they are it's a fundamentally insecure country. I think that's one of the most important things to understand about China. Mm. And so I have no doubt they'll, particularly in this region, be very active in trying to make sure that they, they clearly want to establish themselves. This is again not a very novel observation as the dominant power in Asia, because it's not that they're an expansionist. Power in the traditional sense, although one could argue that they're expansionist as far as the South China Sea is concerned, but I think it's driven by a sense of insecurity about the U.S. Navy might someday choke off our economy over some fight about who knows what Taiwan. And we want to make darn sure. I mean, America did this in the Monroe Doctrine. Everyone's heard of that. We did it. I'm just sort of babbling on here, but yeah, I think they will step in, and they will step in whether the U.S. Tries to exercise that type of leadership or not.
So going back to the WTO and its roles and the important role it had to play in China's domestic economic reforms. One of the key elements of the WTO's role, so free trade is one of them, dispute resolution is another one, this idea of national treatment, that foreign corporations are treated the same as national corporations in the host nation. Now, China signed on to the WTO. How's it going on that one?
Well, this is one of the biggest complaints, foreigners have about China's current economic policies is that when their multinationals have invested in China and set up plants that there are all kinds of ways the Chinese have figured out of. Insisting that if you want to invest here, you've got to partner up with a Chinese company, and you've got to hand over your technology. If you want to have access to our, this is the biggest market in the world. We know you all think you have to be here, and I've talked to many multinational, CEOs of multinational corporations say we have to be in China. It's such a big market. This is a big problem for the system. If an economy that's as big as China, if it's just Vietnam doing it, or some a medium sized economy that's playing that kind of game, then the system can kind of stumble along and ignore it, and maybe there'll be a few WTO cases, and they'll lose some and they'll win some. But when it's China and they're so good at using these institutions that they set up after 2003 that have exercised so much influence over the way their state-owned enterprises work, the decisions they make, and then remember each state-owned enterprises and each private company in China has a Communist Party committee. Even IBM China has a Communist Party committee, and Xi Jinping has been pushing this. The party. I mean, people thought when he came in, maybe he'll try to lay off more. No, he's been pushing much more for giving the party much more authority over over the actions of enterprises. So these Communist Party committees can affect the kinds of decisions that companies make. So they're very, but it's obviously completely non-transparent. I mean, the Communist Party committee of the number one, first auto works up in the Northeast, they don't publish the minutes of their meetings where they say, well, we're going to do such and so. So this is all very non-transparent. And this is a big problem for foreign companies if the Chinese government is trying to promote their own domestic national champions. It's a violation of the spirit of national treatment. Try to prove it. Try to prove the Chinese get hauled before the WTO and they say, well, where's your proof that we've violated these rules? Countries will just say, well, I can't bring a case because I can't get the evidence. And part of the reason that they can't get the evidence is that foreign companies are afraid of going to I've talked to people in Beijing, the US government say foreign companies are afraid to come, they're even afraid to be seen coming to the embassy because they know that the Chinese authorities will, they're pretty good at monitoring that kind of thing. And oh, you're bringing a complaint against us? Well, let's see how things go when you want your next contract or you want to do your next expansion. Maybe there'll be problems for you. So companies know that they may be retaliated against. And this is this is a big problem for the system.
And is the WTO obviously aware of that? Is it doing anything to make channels in so that these can be more aptly dealt with?
Well, I think there's a pretty good argument that the WTO rules just are not designed for an economy that works the way China does. Could we just stumble along and let China get away with this? Well, maybe we could. And maybe that would be a good thing, because after all, I think a strong China is a lot better for the world than a weak China. But when you've got a big, big player like this that's behaving this way, the perception of unfairness in a rules-based system, when they say, well, the rules are really good, and the Chinese are very good about obeying the rules. They really take this seriously, that we are a responsible country. We are not scofflaws. But when they can get away with violating the spirit of the rules, that's a big problem for this.
And surely that must undermine the interest of companies to bother in China. Right. I mean, it's difficult enough as it is, I believe, to make a success of China, and if this is the case as well. So is it really in China's best interests or to their advantage to do that?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, foreign companies, I mean, particularly in the American business community, used to be the biggest boosters of China. It was really something to behold how they would go, just bang on and on about how, they are going to change. We're going to go in there and they're going to become more like us. And of course, they're never going to become exactly. I mean, it's China, right? It's this ancient civilization and all that. But you'll see, they will be, and now they are very sour. And most recently, every year the American Chamber of Commerce in China, in Beijing, goes to Washington, what they call their annual door knock. This was just a few weeks ago, and they were all, jumping up. This is a long-term trend. This isn't something that's just happened this past year, but they're basically saying, we no longer are nearly as enthusiastic about this, and we've got a really serious problem here. Is it in China's interest? Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't think that it's, I think that I'm enough of a believer in markets to think that, the industrial policy can boomerang on you, to use an Australian word. I'm not sure that it is in their interest in terms of promoting their long-term economic development, but I was always skeptical of the argument that the Japanese industrial policy was so brilliant and successful. That we all may as well just go to the beach and forget it because they're going to be taking over everything. And I think that turned out to be wrong. Who knows what we'll see with China. But they're doing it.
I think the same seems to be true for Australian companies as well, that there's been a lot more support from the Australian economic commercial side of the China-Australia relationship, but there's a lot of difficulties that people are facing as well. So now, 2001 versus 2017. 2001 in China, we had this particular political set of circumstances, particular economic set of circumstances that meant that acceding to the WTO seemed like an excellent idea, that we wanted SOE reform, it was needed. Mm-hmm. And as you said, we've had politics since then going, strengthening SOE, strengthening state control. Do you think that today, in 2017, China is anywhere near as amenable to enmeshing itself in the international global governance system as it was then? And why not, or why? And what do you think the implications there?
I think two things really have happened that have changed the Chinese attitude about all this. I mean, one was the global financial crisis. I'm sure you've had the same kind of conversations that I've had with Chinese, to say, boy, that really disillusioned us. We thought, we were moving in this direction where we thought, your system is really great, and suddenly we saw, talking about Americans. Australia, you all came through the global financial crisis pretty well, but we didn't. And that had a huge impact on the Chinese, saying, well, wait a minute, maybe this system isn't as great as we thought. And the crises that have occurred elsewhere, in the Eurozone, they can kind of see that we have what's the expression, feet of clay or whatever. We the West, not Australia. So. I think as China has gotten as wealthy and as powerful as it has, they are increasingly, understandably, saying, well. We like rules-based systems, but these were systems that these are rules that you guys made, not us. And yes, we agreed to them in the WTO, and we'll abide by the ones we've signed on to. But there are certain areas where we'd like to be instead. We're not just going to be rule takers. We're going to be rule makers.
Can you give any examples of that, those kinds of things?
Well, I mean, the creation of the AIIB, is, we don't necessarily want the World Bank to be just the only development institution. We'd like to have one that we have more control over. In the international monetary system, they're increasingly asserting, a desire to affect the way the rules are going to be written. They're not understandably, being a big, powerful country now, less enthusiastic about, and obviously, perhaps the most worrisome example of this is in the law of the sea. I mean, where they're saying, well, we didn't, know your rules about the law, which of course the United States has never formally ratified, because of our brilliant politicians in the Senate. They're saying, no, we have our own ideas about how the rules ought to be written there, and we're not going to take what was dictated to us. And that's obviously a potential point of huge conflict.
And what do you think? I mean, we've got to turn to Q&A in a minute, so please think of some questions that you'd like to ask. But what do you think then ultimately that means? What does that add up to for our global economic governance system at this time?
I can't help but feel terribly concerned that, if the, and I think, China presents the threat that I was just talking about, but obviously the Trump administration presents, in many ways, a much more dire threat. I mean, Bob Lighthizer, the trade representative, is a very fierce and very knowledgeable. I have to say, he's not a Trump clone. I mean, Wilbur Ross, you know, some of these other, and this guy, my God, this guy Peter Navarro, you know, who's Trump's China advisor. I mean, this is awful, horrible, racist nativism. But Lighthizer, I think, you're going to see is going to be asserting himself. He's now gotten Senate confirmation. He's a big critic of the way the WTO has worked. He feels it's been to the disadvantage of American industry and in China's favor. And he knows where the bodies are buried, and he knows how to manipulate the system. I'm not completely convinced that he's going to be able to call all the shots. I don't think he wants to blow up the WTO. He wants to force it to move in directions that a lot of countries are going to be very uncomfortable with. And the threat is, well, if you're not willing to go along with that, then we are going to blow it up. At his confirmation hearing just the other day, he said it would be horrible, if the WTO doesn't give us the kind of decision we want. You know, China wants market economy status, right? This is one of the, they were, under their terms of their accession, they were supposed to get market economy status in 15 years after acceding. And the U.S. has said no. And this is not Trump, this is the Obama administration, Europe, all, and I think Australia has given market economy status under, basically, the other countries have said, well, we said we would give this to you, but look, there's these little phrases in the rules here, and we don't think that we have to give it quite in the way that you think. And the Chinese are saying, all right, we're going to haul you before a tribunal. You're violating what you said you were going to do. So this is now a case in the WTO, and Lighthizer has basically said, well, if the WTO rules against us on this, it'll be disastrous. I think that was the word he used, for the WTO. Basically saying, if you don't do what we want, we're blowing it up. We're in a dire situation here.
So on that note, where oddly enough it seems that the system seems to be in trouble, but not so much from China as from the US. Extraordinary. I'll turn to the audience, and very interested to hear your questions. The microphones will come around, so please just raise your hand and identify. Give us your name and your affiliation.
Hi, thank you, Paul. Alex Carradas, no affiliation. Just taking your last comment there, what are the consequences of that?
The consequences of the WTO being blown up?
Correct.
Yeah.
Metaphorically.
Metaphorically, yes, 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 yes. I know, you have to be careful not to talk about violence to suggest that you're encouraging it. I get starry-eyed about the multilateral system. I know I look old, but I wasn't around in the 1930s, but I've read about it. It's all too easy. I mean, I don't think that the world is going to go back to the 1930s necessarily, but when you have a multilateral system that works as well as this one does, where countries, instead of, the strong bullying the weak, and instead of countries, you know, basically sort of declaring economic war on each other, saying, you did that to me, all right, I'm doing this to you. Instead, the trade minister gets up in front of the cameras and says, these people are, you know, they're cheating, and we're going to do something about it. We're going to sue them. We're going to go to the WTO. You have an actual system of law where you can go to a neutral arbiter and get redress. That's fantastic. That's the way the world ought to work this way in every realm, in my opinion. But of course, it's unrealistic to expect that it will. But in trade, we did it. We had the general agreements on tariffs and trade. It was created after the Second World War. It was a rather weak system. But then in 1995, kind of at the most enthusiastic moment for globalization, the countries came together and created the World Trade Organization. And it's a wonderful system. It isn't perfect. When countries, you know, sometimes countries will bring cases against each other, and you know, it takes a long time to get for the case to grind through the process. So, and at the end, what happens? The WTO court says, you know, you're right, you're guilty of violating the rules. All that has to happen, the country says, okay, I'll stop doing it. You don't get any retro. You can't win damages for what's been done to you already. So it's not a perfect system. It's not a perfect rule of law. It's not quite like the analogy to domestic courts is a bit far fetched, but it's close. And again, when countries have grievances against each other, when the trade minister gets up and says, "We'll take them to the WTO," it's amazing. I mean, time and again. The clamor to, okay, well, let's wait to see, you know, let's wait for the, we know we're right, and we will prevail, and justice will be done, and national, you know, furors tend to settle down. So that's a good thing, I think, because, you know, trade isn't the be-all and end-all of everything. I mean, countries, you know, and when countries start declaring economic war on each other, tempers tend to get hot, and sooner or later, you know, maybe something more serious will start. So I think it's a great institution. We ought to be doing everything we can to protect it. And if it blows up, again figuratively, who knows what else will start blowing up? I'm not saying if the WTO falls apart, World War III will start. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's too, you know, who can predict? Regional institutions may come along and at least, tamp some of this down. But I think it's an institution well worth protecting. And it may not live to see its 20th birthday. Excuse me, its 25th birthday. It's 20th.
Thanks for that question. There's a question just down at the front here, please.
Thank you. My name is John West. I teach in Japan at Sophia University, I might contact you. Oh. Congratulations on an excellent presentation. One thing you haven't mentioned is the One Belt, One Road. And as far as I understand, that is a hub and spoke arrangement centered on Beijing rather than being a normal multilateral organization. Do you have any comments on it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a... It has no. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable for the Chinese to want to promote, infrastructure that helps their economy connect with other parts of the world. I don't think it poses any particular threat to the system in that sense. But I mean, it's. It would be nice if it were done in a way that promoted national treatment, in which Chinese would welcome participation by enterprises that aren't Chinese in it. But China has never signed up for what's called the government procurement agreement in the WTO. I mean, they've signed up for, you know, the rules in governing private companies and private transactions are covered by the WTO agreements. But when the government buys something, many countries in the world, certainly Australia, United States, you know, are all members of the government procurement agreement, which means that they have to abide by WTO rules and respect national treatment rules. Now they don't have to respect. The United States doesn't have to respect Chinese companies because China's not in the government procurement agreement. They have to respect all the countries that are in the government procurement agreement. But China's not in that, and their government buys a lot of stuff because their government is big and its tentacles are everywhere. So, One Belt, One Road may be perceived as a bit unfair in that regard, but it's not. It's probably sensible. It's a bit pie in the sky, I think. I mean, there's aspects of it that it's not very well clearly formulated exactly how it's a bit more, something that is just sort of dreamy aspects to it, but...
Not a threat to the system.
No, I don't think so.
On the government procurement agreement, I remember in Beijing, when I was there, there was a lot of debate about it, and the people who were pro the government procurement agreement were those who were worried about what kind of cars they would be driving. I was concerned they wouldn't be able to drive Audis if they had to buy. And that was a very big issue. Can I take the microphone to this gentleman here, please?
Thank you. Brian Everingham, Australian Institute for International Affairs. I'm curious as to your opinions on the impact of the corporate debt that Chinese companies now carry, whether or not that will tip the balance for growth.
I've certainly read a good deal about this in the newspapers, but it's not something I feel particularly expert about. China in recent years, particularly since after the global financial crisis, they wanted a big lending binge to make sure that their economy, and they, you know, regarded this as something that they could do to help the global economy stay afloat. And they pumped a tremendous amount of money out of state-owned banks into state-owned enterprises. They may very well have some type of financial crisis as a result of that. But this is all state-owned banks lending to state-owned enterprises. It's really funny. You talk to Chinese about lending to state. You know, you say, well, it's really unfair. Your state-owned enterprises get really cheap credit from state-owned banks, and that's an unfairness in the system. They say, you don't understand. State-owned banks, I mean, they really are run just the way Western. They really are run on a profit-oriented basis. The executives of the banks are judged by how well they do in terms of earning profits. And they lend to state-owned enterprises because they know that those are safe. They know that the government will back them up. Well, there's a certain circularity to all this. I guess my feeling is that, you know, there may be some type of growth slowing episode as some of those loans. Badness of some of those loans becomes evident, but I don't think that that's something the Chinese government can't control. They have so much control over the money that comes in and the money that goes out. It's very much unlike the countries that have fallen into financial crises in recent years, where a big part of the problem was that foreign money poured in over-enthusiastically, lulled the government into complacency, and then the money flies out. This is what we were talking about last night about financial crises. But, I can't rule out the possibility that China would have a serious financial crisis as a result of this, but it's, and they may, you know, their asset, you know, their stock market may take a big dip, but...
Unlikely. Yeah.
Well, and it's unlikely to affect the economy. I mean, a lot of Chinese who may be poor, who speculated in stocks. This happens, seems to happen with a fair degree of regularity there. I have to admit, I find it rather enjoyable because the speculation that seizes Chinese investors is really makes you roll your eyes.
Okay, grab a question just down here, please.
And John Connor, it's an excellent summary of China. I'd like to ask a question or an observation and a question, taking a somewhat longer view. If you go back in China's history, there are long periods, in fact, most of China's history, the state interfered against innovation. And that's why Needham produced his umpteen volumes of Chinese inventions, which were never adopted. So there's a long history of that. And so you had a state that was constantly and continuously intervening in commercial decisions, which frankly seems to be more and more what's happening now. And allied with that in China, is, to my view, is an incredible misuse of much capital. Yes, Shanghai subway system is a marvel, but you go to small provincial towns or villages which have a railway station which is of extraordinary dimensions for two trains a day and will never have more. You have airports built when there's already a perfectly serviceable airport, you've got another new airport being built 50 kilometres away, which, like some Spanish airports, will never have more than two planes a day if it has that. Huge misuse of capital. You've got the state-owned enterprises, or state-controlled enterprises more accurately, having privileged sources of capital. At the same time, you've got among the most innovative companies in China, not in the IT area, but in manufacturing, starved of capital because they cannot get bank loans. So much of what I now see in China actually leads me to think that, no, you're not going to have the sort of financial crisis that you'd have if you had huge external borrowings. But what you may finish up with is a very low rate of growth and a huge resulting from a huge misuse of capital and a society, or it's not a society, but a state that is actually concerned in the end more about its own preservation than innovation. Do you think that's a fair summary?
I think that's brilliant. I can hardly think of anything to add. I think they ought to be worried. Coming back to Meriden's question about, you know, is this in China's interest? I have not been to some of the places you've been in recent, but it's entirely credible to me that that a lot of bridges to nowhere have been built in effect. I mean, maybe they're not as bad as bridges to nowhere, but they're in effect, as you say, it's misallocation of capital and waste of precious resources that could very well. Once the music stops and everyone realizes that that a lot of money's been wasted, the fast rate of growth that's to some extent kind of just propelled itself would slow down. That makes a lot of sense to me. My concern with China's economic policies. It's not so much that they've figured out this vastly superior system as people worried about Japan 20, 30 years ago, that it's going to triumph over ours and leave us all impoverished while they go on to great triumph. It's the perception that they're not really playing by the spirit of the rules that I think does pose a real concern for the survival of the trading system, but if it undermines the trading system, that will hurt them, and if the misallocation is as bad as you suggest, and it's quite credible to me that it would be, then that will also hurt them.
I think we've got time for just one last question, just up at the back here, please.
Yeah, John Langdale, Macquarie Uni. Just a little follow-up to the previous comment. It strikes me as the key problems China's facing are internal domestic problems, corruption, crime, aging population, massive environmental pollution. And these problems are just not going to go away. They're going to get worse, if anything. So it's rather than the external issues about the WTO and so forth, it strikes me as China faces huge domestic problems, and it's going to take generations to really come to grips with these.
Yes. The government, they may be misallocating capital, but I think they are genuinely concerned with making sure that the music doesn't stop, and that people don't have the perception that their lives are improving, perceptibly year after year, because that's the whole basis of their legitimacy now. The communist dream faded a long time ago, So they know that if they don't address some of those problems, there may very well be a rebellion in the street. But to come back to the previous question, and to your point about corruption, dealing with pollution and with misallocation of capital, that may If there's a problem with corruption and powerful people in local government, I mean, local government is also a historically huge problem for that country. The center is never able to, you know, fully force the far-flung provinces to toe the line. So these are, you know, tremendous trade-offs that they've got to deal with. If there's powerful local officials, forcing them to clean up something or forcing them to give up their bridges to nowhere is not so easy. I don't discount that for a minute. I think that this is a country, as I say, they're insecure about the external threat, and they have tremendous internal problems. I mean, they've come a huge way, but got a long way to go.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that sums it up rather nicely, that, you know, that conundrum between the domestic imperatives and the international engagement and the complications that China has in balancing those. Ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of the session. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is one of our AMP China series. And so I'd like to invite a representative from ANP to come up and give a vote of thanks. So if I could invite Mr. Beng Neo, who is the Managing Director of North Asia, to come up. We'll just get your microphone, Mr. Neo, and close the session.
Thank you. And firstly, thank you very much, Paul, for a very insightful talk today. And I think we certainly get a lot from it. And I'd like to echo in terms of some of the things that you highlighted. I think, you know, looking at where China was in 2001 and where China is today, from just over 1 trillion to 11-point-something trillion, that's a remarkable progress and a remarkable achievement. And I think in the process, the most important thing is that there are hundreds of millions of people who actually benefit from it, in terms of the people coming out from poverty and all that. And I think that for us in AMP, we've been looking into China for a long time. We've been there for over 20 years. And for us, we're very excited in terms of what's been happening there. We saw in many ways we benefit from the WTO ascension, because as part of WTO, China started to open up its financial services sector, whilst others would argue for more. But for us, we've been able to work with China Life, our strategic partner in China over the last 11 years, and be able to secure 2 joint ventures with them. And this is where we bring out the best of what we got in AMP, which is superannuation and pension. And, you know, Paul, you touched on in terms of the aging issue, which we all share, but China is actually in a much bigger scale, and also in wealth management. So it is important for us as financial services player to be able to look at in terms of how to help in terms of the financial system to be that robust in terms of that would also help in terms of some of the efficient allocation of capital. So thank you again, Paul. And of course, thank you to Lowy Institute for giving AMP the opportunity to be part of this series.
Thank you. And thank please you. Join me in thanking Paul Bluestein. Thank you, everybody.
Great question.